Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced by WEKU and Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. Over the years, Medicare and Social Security have been considered bedrock programs people plan their retirement around and count on in times of illness, disability, or simply old age. But something shifted. A growing share of Americans aren't just worried about tweaks at the margins. They're not sure the programs will even be there in the near future. That comes through in polling by Gallup in a survey commissioned by the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. So what's driving this new level of anxiety? What does it mean for people trying to make real-life decisions about work, retirement, and health care? And as policymakers debate the long-term finances of both programs, how do we separate political rhetoric from what the numbers actually say? All questions from Mike Murphy, joining us from the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget in Washington, where he manages policy research and analysis. Welcome, Mike.
Thank you for having me.
So Gallup describes this as one of the largest public opinion efforts on perceptions of Medicare and Social Security. Nearly 20,000 adults fielded June 9th through August 25th via web in English. What does that methodology do well, and what might it have missed?
Well, I think it's really good that Gallup is trying to gauge public opinion on these programs. Look, they are two of the most popular, based on other polls too, programs in the federal budget, but they also are two of the largest programs in the federal budget if you examine them by the amount of federal spending that goes towards them. They're actually the two largest federal programs. And so I think they are right on their methodology to get general opinion on it. And I think that it's not necessarily what they're missing, but what I think they're getting at a little bit without stating it is that the anxiety is correct for these people to share it. These are programs that are, as you likely know, projected to go insolvent within a decade, within less than 7 years, based on the latest projections. In fact, by 2032, which I would add is also may seem like a long ways off, but actually will be within the last year of the term of anyone elected to the United States Senate this year. So it is not that far off, and I think their anxiety is rightly placed.
The survey finds that about 6 in 10 say they're more concerned now than they were a year ago about changes to benefits, 58% for Medicare, 61% for Social Security. What changed in the country's mood in just a year's time?
That's a good question of what may have changed. There have been reports by the trustees, by those that examine the finances, that actually in the last year, the finances of Social Security and Medicare have worsened just in the last year. So although the trustees for these programs have been projecting they were going to go insolvent in the 2030s for quite some time now, there were some actions, including as a result of some of the changes in the One Big Beautiful Bill Act last year, some other policy changes that actually moved up the date of insolvency by a year. That got a little bit of news attention. It's possible that some people were concerned about that. I think that there were other issues going on surrounding Social Security in the last year that people probably were hearing about. You know, things where the DOGE, Department of Government Efficiency effort, was talking about some things in Social Security. So maybe people got a sense that maybe they thought something's going on there that maybe they should be worried about. But I think those are probably some of the drivers. But I think if you look at polling for some time, I think it is consistent with the idea that a lot of people are aware that there is some kind of underlying financial problem with Social Security. They've been kind of hearing about this in the news for some time. They kind of know it's hanging out there. They might not know exactly when. So it's not a surprise that this anxiety is there and it is getting maybe a little worse.
What would be your best read on why the doubt is highest among adults under 50, where half or more say it's not likely Medicare or Social Security will be there for them in a decade?
That has also been a consistent finding in polls going back as long as I can remember on this issue for the last several years, is that young people in particular are very concerned about the fact that it won't be there for them. They're completely cynical to that. I think part of that is maybe driven just by an overall cynical view, frankly, of government. And young people have maybe grown up in an era where they are more distrustful of what government can follow through on than maybe others that have been around for a longer period of time. I also think it is driven by reality. And what I mean by that is they are the ones that will bear the brunt of this over a longer period of time. And it is true that they should be concerned about the security of Social Security for them because of the reasons I said before. Now, that being said, there also is a little bit of a misunderstanding when it comes to young people's views on whether it's going to be there. The reality is it is going to be there. Even the projections that show it's going to go insolvent, that doesn't actually mean it's completely bankrupt and will have no money coming in to the fund. What it actually means is it's going to have to result, if they actually allowed it to go insolvent, it would result in a cut that has to match benefits with the revenues coming in at the time. And that would equal about, by our estimates and others, about a 24% cut. Obviously, that's a very drastic outcome and one that should be avoided, but it doesn't mean it's going away. So there is a little nuanced misunderstanding that it's actually not going to go away, but there, young people are right to be more concerned.
Among those who are talking about a fix of some sort, is there any talk about the eligibility age going up, access getting tighter, something like that?
There are, those are ideas that are out there. There are a variety of ideas that have been talked about in, let's just say, public policy circles for some time. I would say it's much more rare, frankly, for political figures and politicians to stick their neck out a little bit here on Social Security and offer such specific ideas. And the reason they don't do so is because it is the quintessential third rail. They know that any time they might mention something like this, they're going to get attacked by those that think that they're taking away their benefits. And so, but some of those ideas you mentioned have been out there in public policy circles for a while. There are people that believe it would be a reasonable idea to prospectively raise the eligibility age for retirement. The last time they fixed Social Security for solvency issues back in the 80s, they started to slowly raise the age decades ahead from that point. They could do something like that again to account for the fact that we're living longer and to account for life expectancy. But there are also common proposals put forward on that's the one that you just said is on the benefit side. There's on the revenue side too. Mm-hmm. There are ideas surrounding how do we adjust some of the revenue coming into the program right now. As you know, and many of your listeners may know, Social Security, you stop paying payroll taxes on it when you reach a certain income. Now, right now, it's about $180,000 a year. And there are various proposals of how do you adjust that cap, given we haven't really adjusted it for total wages in the economy in some time. And so there are ideas like that, too. The bottom line is there's lots of actual ideas out there in policy circles. People actually know the levers you can pull to adjust Social Security going forward. What it really is going to take is the political will, as I was saying, because of the third rail nature of this makes it very, very challenging.
Yeah, I've heard it said that politicians are saying we won't touch Social Security are actually on the wrong path, that everybody wants them to touch Social Security in a way that preserves it.
That's right.
From the trustees' perspective, Social Security's old age and survivors' insurance trust funds projected to face depletion in the early 2030s, unless changes are made, and soon. So in light of what you just said, where is Congress? Where can we confidently feel Congress is right now on making sure that these programs continue?
Unfortunately, Congress is nowhere on this. And the reason I say is multiple. I certainly said one of them already. One of them is this is the total political hot potato. It is one where given the polarized nature of our political climate, I think it's safe to say that there's lots in both parties that might prefer to keep this issue out there to kind of hammer the other side of someone that might dare propose something as opposed to coming together and solve it. That doesn't happen just on Social Security. That happens on a range of issues, but it certainly is the case on Social Security. But the other issue is just is timing. I said this is 2032 when they're projected to go insolvent. I believe that that's actually not a long ways off when you're thinking about how important this program is, the fact that you should phase in changes to allow people time to adjust, the fact that you can give more options on the table now as opposed to if you wait to the last minute. There's lots of smart reasons to get ahead of it, but our political calendar doesn't work like that. Our political calendar is kind of operating by deadline, operating by kind of next crisis. And so it's hard to get the politics to focus on something that might be a few years away. I'd say those are the two main issues. There are a lot of people that understand it, want to solve it, but they know the politics are difficult and that they operate on what's the crisis of this week, frankly.
So it sounds likely that we're going to get into a situation where the third rail is inches away And there is no solution yet. Is that your prognosis?
Well, it's certainly possible, but I like to be an optimist on this stuff, believe it or not, coming from someone who does a fiscal responsibility organization. Mm-hmm. And the reason I say that is because I think that there is the possibility that because voters do care about Social Security a lot, and we've seen some polling, not the one that we were talking about earlier, but other polling that suggests that, yes, people may know Social Security is in trouble, but they actually are not aware that it's only 6 years away. They are not aware that when you get to that point, you could have a cut of 24% of benefits if you don't do anything about it. And we've seen evidence that if you say that to people, it actually changes voters' opinions on wanting to focus on it and wanting to get some attention on it. So I say all that because it's an election year, and election years present opportunities for people to raise it to those running for office. And I do think those that are running for the Senate, because they're going to have to be confronted with this, it looks like within their terms. I'm an optimist that maybe this can become an issue in these Senate elections. And once it becomes an issue in some of the Senate elections, and certainly should be an issue for whoever's running for the president in 2028, then you can see the dynamic where maybe you get ahead of this instead of waiting till 2032. So that's my optimistic take of what I think can happen if voters start to demand action on this.
Well, that in mind, just to clarify, just to be clear on this, on what happens in 6 years if nothing's done, 24% cut in benefits, for example, are we talking about a cut in benefits that are being received now, the level of benefits being received now, or a cut in future benefits and those being received now are protected somehow?
So it would be a 24% across the board cut at that time. So like there'd be no grandfathering in. It's not just cuts to people at that time and thereafter. Because the way that the law works is they would have to do an across the board cut to match the benefits at that time to the revenues coming in. And it's just a math equation. Now look, I am not immune to the fact that many people suggest that they meaning political leaders and politicians in Washington, won't ever let that cut happen. I don't think that's a 0% chance. I think some crazy things happen. But here's what I also worry about, is if you get to that point, a couple of possible outcomes happen. Number one is they borrow. They basically say, okay, yeah, we can't come together on this, so we're going to borrow from the rest of the federal government added to the credit card to just keep Social Security going. That creates a big problem. Number one, because we're already $38 trillion in gross national debt right now, with interest costs being the fastest growing expense in our federal budget. That is really putting a big threat to our economy and national security. So it's bad for that reason, but it's also bad for anyone who cares about Social Security, because then what happens to Social Security is it's no longer a self-financed system. It's no longer, and it will become another political football that they just punt every couple months, every couple of years. And that anxiety we talked about in that poll will just become ever going and ever increasing. So, you know, I hope that we don't get to that point because it would be a drastic cut. And those that suggest that they won't ever let it happen, that might be true, but it also would have dire consequences both for the program if they do that and for our fiscal and economic health.
Well, if we took borrowing off the table, what's left as far as replenishing the revenues?
Yeah, I mean, there's not much left after that. You either have to borrow or you have to raise taxes or cut benefits to basically make that solvent. It's pretty simple at that point. And so that's why I think the least common denominator, or least difficult thing for politicians to do, would be to sort of transfer some money from the general fund, et cetera. But again, I've heard someone say to me, when I say that to them, they go, what general fund? Because again, we're already borrowing to finance the ongoing cost of government to begin with.
All right, that's Mike Murphy joining us from the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. Thank you so much, Mike.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
Rufus Friday, a recent president and publisher of the Lexington Herald Leader, today heads the Center for Integrity in News Reporting. And it's that role in these times of revolutionary changes in the ways we access and consume information and worry about its quality that captured the interest of Eastern Standard contributor Gerald Smith.
Welcome, Rufus Friday, to Eastern Standard.
Thank you, Dr. Smith. I greatly appreciate you having me on. I feel honored.
All right, we're going to jump right in discussing your position as well as your work for the Center for Integrity in News Reporting. So what is the mission?
Give you a little bit of backstory on that, Dr. Smith. Just want to let you know that the center was created last year, and it was really established to kind of solve the issue of regaining the public's trust in media. The Gallup poll puts out a poll every single year. They've been doing this since the early 70s on trust in media. And going back as far as 1972, trust in media was at an all-time high. It was in the high 70% range. And probably people remember, more importantly, Walter Cronkite and David Brinkley around during those times. But since that time, you know, in the past 50 years, it's just precipitously gone down to where Gallup does this poll and they put it out every September. And that number had gone down yet again from 31% trust in media to only 28%. So the media in general has a less trust than Congress, which has been historically been the one that's been least trusted. So it was created by a gentleman by the name of Walter Hussman, who he's a third generation news media professional that's based in Little Rock, Arkansas. His grandfather started a newspaper over 109 years ago in Texarkana, Texas, and then subsequently bought another number of newspapers throughout the Midwest, primarily the flagship, which is in Arkansas. Walter's father was the publisher there for about 50 years, and Walter Hussman was publisher there for about 48 years until he retired. But then he just got concerned about what was going on in general within the media that he and his grandfather and his father had spent most of the majority of their lives. He wanted to do something to try to reach out and regain the public's trust in media. So he established a center, and it was, more importantly, the mission was really simple but kind of ambitious, and it was to reduce the bias in news reporting and to rebuild the public's trust. And the center takes a multifaceted approach in doing that, in that, number one, we really believe in rewarding those that are doing good, impartial, objective news reporting in the four primary media platforms: broadcast, cable, TV, and digital. This past year, we added an additional award where we recognized someone from the White House Correspondents Association for their reporting. And those awards are judged by an independent group of press association managers, and they select the winners from those five categories. And we provide them with a $25,000 cash award for winning. And then we select two finalists, and they get $1,000 each. We have a nice awards dinner up in Washington, D.C. at the Library of Congress, where we bring those winners up. They get an all-expenses-paid trip there. We have individuals in the academic world, Fortune 500, in the political world to come and be a part of this celebration and recognition as well. We bring on a good speaker that talks about the importance of a free press and the First Amendment as well. And secondly, one of our additional initiatives is that we invite these distinguished journalists that have won these awards to help us go into journalism schools and give guest lectures and teach classes and explain, you know, how to give news impartially without any kind of fear or favor, which is what the press was built on. More importantly, we encourage those journalism schools as well as news organizations to adopt a statement of core journalistic values in news reporting, but more importantly, visibly put those out there in front of the public so the public can see exactly what your values are as a news entity and an organization. And Walter did this at his news organizations about 6 years ago and got a tremendous amount of feedback from the news organizations that he owns that you know, people were calling him up and saying, hey, now I'm glad we know what your journalistic values are. And more importantly, we know how to hold you accountable when your news reporting does venture into the opinion side. We also encourage the public to look at rewarding those news organizations that have a forward-facing statement of core journalistic values by supporting them with their subscriptions, with donations, by viewing them. And we feel like that will be one way that we can help turn the needle around in regaining the public's trust in media by just letting individuals know what these media companies stand for when it comes to impartial news reporting.
So what are the greatest challenges facing the media in today's society?
Right now, the biggest issue that the media has is that the lines have been blurred between what's news and what's opinion. I know the number of individuals that watch any kind of newscast, they don't know if they're watching a news segment or if they're watching an opinion segment. And one of the things that we've been trying to work on is getting these entities to understand that there has to be a distinction between news and opinion, both those that are providing it and those who are consuming the news as well. So we feel like that there is just no place for opinion in news reporting. Unfortunately, the tide out there right now is a big push to eliminate objectivity in news reporting. Arizona State University did a survey back in 2023, and they were asking about objectivity to about 75 news editors, and they said that they were getting away from objectivity and going to more of a advocacy journalism. And there were all good news is back then when that happened 2 years ago, there was quite a bit of pushback. New York Times put out an op-ed and stating that we need to bring back objectivity. A.G. Sulzberger, who runs it, put out a good piece on it as well. And then Marty Baron, who was at the Washington Post at the time, he put out a really nice op-ed talking about the importance of objectivity. He said, look, the public expects to have objective judges. They expect to have an objective doctor, objective scientists, objective lawyers. Why wouldn't the public expect to have objective news reporters giving objective news? And we know that we've been hearing people talk about how much, for the most part, it's impossible to be objective in news reporting. But we like to advocate for that there is a what we call an objective method that you go through. And that is that you try to get both sides or multiple sides of a story. And you follow that story wherever it may take you, whether you like the outcome of it or not. But you should be giving as many sides to that story as possible.
So how is AI impacting the news?
It's had a tremendous impact not only on the news, but then also on news media outlets. I mean, I was up in Washington, D.C., speaking to the folks at Congress about the big tech companies, the Facebooks, the Googles, and the TikToks of the world that are going out and they're scraping news content from traditional news organizations and putting it out on the web without paying the publishers anything at all. And we feel like that there should be, and we've been talking to Congress about protecting the intellectual property of journalists. I mean, I gave an example. I said, you don't go into a Krispy Kreme donut shop and ask for 12 donuts and then you walk out without paying for it. And we feel as though that the news that's being produced by the news media outlets throughout the country should have some form of intellectual property protection over it. And one industry dealt with this a number of years ago when the internet came on the scene. When Napster came on the scene and was taking music content from music labels without paying for it and putting it up online, the music industry, they came up in arms very quickly on that and got legislation put in place to be able to protect their intellectual property. And right now, we just feel like that should take place with the news media as well, because now with AI out there, when you do a search, that AI just gives you a summary without you even going to that website that generated the content in the first place, that had to pay reporters and all kinds of operational costs to generate that. We're hoping that we can get some legislation in place that will put some guardrails on AI.
Okay. So what do you all think about the rules that have been implemented to restrict the press access to the Pentagon?
It's unfortunate that that did take place. I kind of was a little bit closer to that in that I also serve as the board chair for Stars and Stripes newspapers, which is the military newspaper for record for all military personnel. And we were not impacted by this. Our Stars and Stripes newspaper reporters are still in the Pentagon reporting news day in and day out. We don't know exactly where it's going to go as far as, how long that's going to be in play or not. But we, once again, we're all about keeping the press free. And there is a Press Act that we also have been advocating for, that we hope that the folks that will allow the press to have, the freedom to be able to report wherever it needs to report.
So is the Center for Integrity in News Reporting, is it getting much support? Is there some momentum behind the work that you all are pursuing?
We've had some successes. I'll go back to Stars and Stripes. It's the first international news organization that has adopted and published and publishes a forward-facing statement of core values on how they're going to report news and information. We've had a couple of news organizations to actually put public-facing documents out there. So Clarity Media out in Colorado has adopted a state, what they call our commitment, that they put on page 2A of their news organizations out there, as well as on their website. And the Main Street Media Company out of Tennessee, which they own 16 news outlets, they have a statement of core values as well. So we're gaining some traction. There are some entities that have ethics and guidelines that they utilize, but they are fairly long. We're just asking that if they would put something forward facing it that an average viewer and reader can read in 200 words or less. And my job and my role is to go out and try to reach out to as many of these entities and the various media platforms that I possibly can to encourage them to do that. I was in New York speaking to the folks at ABC, CBS, and NBC about it as well. So, you know, just right now we're trying to cultivate this idea of, we feel like that having a statement of core values, specifically at this point in time, on how you're going to impartially cover news reporting is most important for these different media platforms.
So how can the public help the media?
One thing that they can do, and I spoke at several Rotary clubs in certain cities of late, and I said, you know, the thing about it is we've had conversations with your local media outlet, and we've encouraged them to adopt a statement of core values so that you will know from a journalistic perspective, how are they going to cover the news for you? How are they going to make sure that they separate opinion out of news reporting and give you unvarnished news reporting? And we're encouraging the public to call up or write or send a message electronically to your local news outlet, whether it be TV, whether it be radio, whether it be print, traditional print, or digital, asking them, do you have a statement of core journalistic values as it pertains to your news reporting? And we feel like that if they don't, then we're encouraging the public to support those that do have it. But then again, we're not a critic. We want to collaborate, and we want to work with as many news entities as possible to let them know that it's a crisis when we have a press that is under so many different stresses and strains as we're having right now, and specifically knowing that, you know, the framers back over 200 years ago it's the only industry that the framers said we need to protect. And we're the only ones that's got an amendment that's tied to protecting what we do. But at the same time, there's been some self-inflicted gunshot wounds that we've done as well. And we've got to own up to the fact that we made some mistakes, and the opinion has crossed over in the news, and that should not happen.
That's Rufus Friday, Executive Director for the Center for Integrity in News Reporting. And I'm Gerald Smith with Eastern Standard.
You're listening to Eastern Standard. I'm Tom Martin. The year-long celebration of Lexington's 250-year history has pulled back the curtain to reveal so many remarkable individuals. Among them was Laura Dolly Johnson Dandridge. And here to share Dolly's story is Mandy Higgins, Executive Director of the Lexington History Museum. Welcome back, Mandy.
Thanks for having me. I'm so excited to talk about Dolly.
Oh, well, tell us about her. Who was Dolly?
So Dolly Johnson Dandridge was born enslaved in Kentucky around 1852. She was a cook, and for a while, she cooked for John Mason Brown, who was a well-known Louisvillian, and even served Theodore Roosevelt in Mr. Brown's home. She was described by John Mason Brown as one of the best cooks in America. So she's coming from Lexington. This is happening. And according to a death notice, Alice Roosevelt's wedding cake was baked by Dolly Dandridge.
Uh-huh.
So she's got this connection to sort of the political elite at the turn of the 20th century. But she's really made her name as the White House cook for President Benjamin Harrison. So Benjamin Harrison moves into the White House in March of 1889, and he inherits a French chef. And his family decides that they are not really French cooking kind of people. They had a, quote, plainer palate. So they hired Dolly. In December of 1889, Dolly managed two kitchens in the White House. She cooked for the first family in their private dining room as well and earned about $75 a month. She stayed for a little over a year and then came back to Lexington to care for an ill child.
And she brought those experiences.
And she brought those experiences back.
And so she opened her own restaurant here, right?
She did. And then she left that restaurant and went back to the White House for a short period in the second Grover Cleveland presidency. So her pay was doubled. She spent about 4 or 5 months and then decided she was done with it and returned to Lexington in 1892, where she opened the White House Cafe.
Do you know where it was?
It was. It was on Main Street. Her husband, Edward, was the chef there, and they cooked meals for folks up and down Main Street, business folks, and they catered.
One of the important revelations of exploring Lexington history has been about the many and the significant contributions and accomplishments of former slaves and their descendants in this town. And I just wonder if you might comment on that.
Yeah, Lexington is really this incredible place always. But the men and women and children who were enslaved here and then found freedom here have made an incredible impact that we can see today in the 21st century. Henry Tandy came to Lexington after the Civil War and opened one of the first really successful African-American-owned businesses in town with his partner, Mr. Bird. They were brick masons and layer. They helped build the old courthouse that you can still visit today and see their masonry work. And his son, Henry's son, Vertner Woodson Tandy, who grew up in Lexington, attended school here before leaving, is the first African-American architect to build post offices. He's honored in New York. He helped build a number of places that we can still see today, including the Chandler Normal School buildings on Georgetown Street. So that family in itself is a really good example of this, and there are so many more.
Yeah, another that comes to mind is Mary Britton.
Mary Britton, we honor her in a new middle school. The first woman and the first African-American woman to have a medical degree and practice as a doctor in Lexington. Before that, she was a teacher. She used her home on Fifth Street as part of her service to the neighborhood. Really incredible. And her family is unbelievable. Her parents were enslaved. Mary's brother was a jockey. She had a sister who was a trained musician. Just really, really incredible family. And there's so many of these stories, athletes and artists and musicians and, you know, down through the ages that we can talk about who've really made that impact. To take it back to Dolly for a second, Dolly died in Lexington in 1918 and is buried in African Cemetery Number 2 alongside so many of these names we're talking about. It's that cemetery on 7th Street that has been preserved and you can visit today, where you can see so many of the connections to the past and where they're buried and where they're honored today.
That's Mandy Higgins. She's the executive director of the Lexington History Museum, and that's at 210 North Broadway. And you can also visit online at lexhistory.org. Thanks, Mandy.
Thank you.
C.D. Collins grew up in Mount Sterling, went on to earn a master's degree in English literature at UK, where she studied under Wendell Berry, and then on to Harvard and to become an originator of the 1990s resurgence of spoken word with live music. But it's her Kentucky roots that inspires Blue Land, a haunting work of Kentucky literature that probes Southern and Appalachian life. We listened in as she sat down for a conversation with Eastern Standard literary contributor Kevin Nance.
C.D., I know you primarily from your work as a spoken word artist. Did you write these stories to be read on a page, or did you write them as spoken word stories and they just transfer to the page? How does that work?
Well, I would write stories, and then when I worked with musicians, I would streamline the stories. I would condense as the musicians came in and formed a melody. I would understand what was coming forward more, and so they ended up being shorter as spoken word pieces than they were originally.
And so the written pieces in your book, Blue Land, they're longer, they're more expansive.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Maybe more detail, more texture.
Yes.
Yeah. Speaking of texture, I feel like one of the most enjoyable aspects of reading your book, at least for me, was this wonderful way that you capture Southern speech, and in particular, to some extent, Appalachian speech. And one of the stories, which is called Hands, and it's about the industry of tobacco in Kentucky and the importance of it in the culture and to these various characters. There's one of the characters, Dreema, who says, "It's so hot you could grill a catfish on the storm drain." Later, she says she's got so much dirt clogged on her feet that she could walk across a busted pop bottle without getting cut. And then later she says, "I have trouble in school because I always start the year late. And because I spell words how they say them at home, like backer instead of tobacco and hire instead of harrow." That kind of wonderful texture is so important in many of the stories. Could you talk about, was that a conscious thing on your part to really kind of get the speech right?
Kentucky speech is poetry to me. I teach English literature. I taught in high school. I've taught in college. And I love correct grammar. I correct people's grammar all day. I'm on a mission for people to get lie and lay right.
And yet.
And yet, I have a man who comes, he's been helping me restore my house for 25 years. And when he speaks, I can't get him on the page. The poetry is so profound. He doesn't repeat himself. So when I was teaching high school, I would have the advanced kids, the regular English, and then the general English. And often the kids came in, sophomores and seniors I taught, and they would come in 6 weeks late because they were housing tobacco, and they'd start the year with all Fs. And when they wrote, the advanced kids were in college prep classes, so they were getting ready for that. And the ones in general English just weren't self-conscious about what they were writing. And I would just savor, they didn't know how to write a 3.8 paragraph. And I would teach them, but I would savor the way they talked, the flavor of it, and the way that they expressed themselves, because they weren't checking themselves. They weren't thinking ACT.
Mm-hmm. And most of the people in your stories are not, I won't say that. I won't say they're not, you know, have higher education. Probably some of them do, some of them don't. And I suppose I also want to say that not all of these stories are set in the South. There's one that's set in California, for example. I want to ask you, though, about the importance of Kentucky. I know you split your time between Kentucky and Massachusetts. You live in a suburb of Boston, I think, right?
I do.
But my sense is that your imagination kind of lives in Kentucky, not so much in Boston. Is that accurate to say?
I had to leave Kentucky to get where I was going. And I went from Kentucky to Boston in 1984. And went to Harvard Extension and met Pamela Painter, who became my mentor. And of course, I'm going to write about people I love and where my heart is, and that's definitely in Kentucky. I've written a few stories set in New England. I wrote a piece called Northern Gothic, but my sensibilities, my image pattern, the music of the speech, and the manners of the people are definitely centered in Kentucky, and my heart is in Kentucky.
You also write about some people, I think, that you don't particularly love. I'm thinking, for example, of the character of the grandfather in one of the stories. A lot of the men in these stories are sort of drunk on their own power, so to speak, and the women and girls around them are kind of under their thumb, and it's almost an unquestioned thing, even by some of the girls. I don't think you ever use the word patriarchy in the book, but it's certainly one of the main forces, the main barriers in these stories, and it's about how these women either had to deal with that or move away or get away somehow.
That's right. I was aware of the patriarchy and the influences, and especially women who were enforcing the patriarchy, which was more complex, or women who were misogynist, such as my mother. And I was fighting against that my whole childhood and my whole adult career. And so I'm against patriarchy, and I think it's such a damaging thing to women and to men. And I see it all around me. It rages in my family. And I hear men being lionized, and I see men getting things unfairly. And I'm not writing essays, so I'm not going to say patriarchy. A woman that was in my band, her name is Noor O'Neill Borbeeva, and she was in Harvard getting a PhD in cultural anthropology. Of all the nerve, she left my band and then went to Notre Dame. She's teaching cultural anthropology at Purdue right now. And she wrote the foreword to the book as a cultural anthropologist. And I remember getting it in the email and waking up and reading it and feeling like someone understands what I'm doing. Not me. She found the words for what I was doing, and she articulates that about how the critique of the patriarchy through story.
Well, she makes a point in her essay that we shouldn't be looking for correspondences between the stories and your autobiography. But that's hard to do, especially if you've seen Gene Donahue's film documentary about you, which is, we know certain things that happened in your life, which definitely are similar to what happens in the stories. You won't think too badly of us if we feel like you drew from your life to write these stories to some extent.
I would say that was more true in my novel, After Heat. I was in a gas explosion when I was 10 years old and burned over 50% of my body. And one of the chapters in After Heat, called Heat, is definitely autobiographical. I'm writing fiction, and that's really important to me. And I don't write about people that I don't love, even if I am critiquing them. I do still love them. I can do through two things at once. I can see my family knocking me around, and then I can love them at the same time. I remember Bernhard Schlink, when they asked him about The Reader. He wrote The Reader, and then it was made into a movie with Kate Winslet. And they asked him if it was autobiographical. And he said, everything is autobiographical, which means to me that I'm seeing life through the lens of my experience. And the people in my stories are alloys of characters. I don't use their real names. It's important to me to use the tools of fiction also. And I'm not writing memoir.
Of course. And I also would like to note that not all the men in your stories are unredeemable. It feels like there's some, for example, Will Coulter. His story, and that's the name of the story, by the way. So that's my favorite of the stories in your book. And it's the most heartbreaking because he starts out kind of rough, and then we begin to see a softness in him, a desire to change. He makes some changes in his life. He has a beautiful romance with a young woman. But then things kind of go downhill from there. That feels to me like a tragic story. It's the tragic story of a man who tries hard to be a real human being rather than, you know, some kind of stereotypical man, and fails to some extent in the end.
What he can do is see the beauty of the world. What he can do is have his hands in the world and create things and do things, and he can have a kinship with animals. In the story, he has the flock of geese following him. What he can't do is have intimacy with another person, with a woman. He's terrified.
Even though he loves her, but he just doesn't have that in him to be a husband.
He's afraid.
Yeah. I would say the most harrowing story in the book is called Sin Vergüenza, which I think translates to something like you have no shame, something like that. And it's a story about a young woman who works at a canning factory in California, and she works hard, but she uses all of her disposable income to buy drugs. And she is a seriously lost drug addict. Could you tell us anything about the genesis of that story and what you would like us to take from it?
She is a woman who has been hurt, and she doesn't trust people, and especially she doesn't trust men. And there's a really good man in there, Polly, is a good guy. And she likes this physicality of her work. She's a tiny person, and she's in these huge machines. She's in a canning factory and the tomatoes and peaches. And she works a shift where she's cleaning them out, and there's these big blades. And she loves that precision. And then she loves the precision of the cocaine. And her family is a mess. Her family, she's trying to take care of them, her mother and her sister. And then this good man comes in, and he cares for her. And she lets him in a little bit. And then she decides it's easier to take the drugs. And so she's going to continue to take the drugs. I have a friend who was a cocaine addict, and I interviewed her about what that was. And I know a lot of medical things. I've been in the hospital, and I know, and I have health issues, so I know what it's like to understand the biology of these things. But I also will faint with talking about blood. And so she would talk to me, and I would interview her, and then I'd have to go lie down because I'd be getting this vagal reaction. So I was getting the information for that story, not from research, but from interviewing my friend.
Well, that's all the time we have for today. C.D., thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you for reading my work so closely. Thank you so much.
C.D. Collins' most recent album, Night Animals, features her musical partner, Santon, a blind, autistic musical savant and summa cum laude graduate of Berklee College of Music. You may want to take the long way home, or if you're already there, settle in your favorite chair for what's coming. We leave you with the C.D. Collins spoken word piece, Dwelling.
I bought my farm when I was 16. People think it was passed to me from my family, but I put my own money down. Even as a teenager, to claim a homestead felt necessary, a place where I'd always be welcome, wouldn't be forced away. I held the deed, 56 acres, two barns, the main house, and a small tenant house. My aunt and uncle lived in the main house for a time. I lived in the tenant house, with a wood stove so porous with tiny rust holes, I could watch the orange embers inside it. Sparks drifted up the chimney, spackling the night sky. I lay under quilts, thinking of the sharecroppers before me, housing tobacco in the barn, hand-digging the 20-foot well. Before them, slaves worked this soil. Before them, Shawnee hunted and fished. I kept ducks and geese, chickens, a milk cow, my calico cat, Lady. When her kittens were born, I sat with her while she pushed her hind paws against my palms. The kits arrived in sacks like sausages, and when their calls broke, they were wet and blind. She licked them clean. I held them up one by one, touched a fingertip to their tiny, perfect paws. I could smell the earth of the womb, as Shawnee mothers must have smelled their children's warmth, wrapped in sacred bundles. As Eve must have smelled her son's warmth, the first newborn children in all the world. Did they smell the salt of the tears that were to come, the ripe fruits of the fleeting paradise? Once I was awakened deep in the night by gunfire and found my uncle clutching a rifle, swaying from whiskey. My aunt stood in the doorway wrapped in a sheet. I didn't say a word. Deep down, I believed I didn't deserve this place with all the acreage and trees. It's a different decade now, even a different century. I've torn the tenant house down, preserving the wood and tin to repair the main house. There was no basement in the tenant house, so now there's just a patch of dirt with groundhog holes, big as a man's thigh. I'm standing on the oak porch in the blue light of dusk when a groundhog pokes her head out of the hole. She emerges, slinks across the yard toward the new garden. She sways her sleek layer of fat under her rough fur. Is her breath scented with hickory nuts and cabbages? Does she know that she is a nuisance digging those holes like that? There's an elaborate burrow under there, a subterranean city. There's a continuous open season for groundhog hunting on private land, but I wouldn't shoot her, even if I had a gun. She trundles on, thinking of her babies, of food. She doesn't worry if her husband drinks, if he's lazy or envies the children. She's a loner. I'm going to fill in the holes so no one will break an ankle. They'll burrow under the woodshed, maybe, or dig under the old horse stalls. They belong here, the groundhogs, those whistle pigs floating out at dusk, the feral cats, too, and foxes with their glowing eyes. They're all welcome here, the does and bucks vaulting the old fence on their way to the pond. They are figures in the dusk, like myself. A shade darker than night. They'll outlast the big house, the good oak porch, the caved-in city, the filled-in holes.
You've been listening to Dwelling by C.D. Collins. Thanks for joining us. Eastern Standard is produced by WEKU and Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer, Neil Kesterson, sound designer and technical director, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. We're on the WEKU, Apple, Spotify, and NPR apps. You can stream all of the interviews from this week's edition online at esweku.org. And while you're there, you can check out our contributors and their interview archives and send thoughts and suggestions to es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard.